This is Jim Fenster, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Today, my special guest is a musician and composer and an expert in digital processing who has been doing what I consider to be brilliant work in the analysis of the videos that were broadcast on 9/11 out of New York. This is one of the most contentious, controversial areas in all of 9/11 research, but in my opinion, he has been doing the cutting-edge work. It's a pleasure to welcome back Ace Baker. Ace, welcome back.
Hey, Jim. Good to be here again.
Just terrific. I'm going to make the guess that you have a page prepared that you'd like to direct us to in terms of pursuing some of these issues further. Am I right?
Well, maybe. I'm maybe a little less together than usual, but I started a little blog, and where is it? It's at, hang on, I'll tell you where that is. You go to 9/11 plane questions.
All right, let me see what I can do here. 9/11
plane, as an airplane, P-L-A-N-E question.
Yeah. 9/11.
Yeah, 9/11 plane questions.
.com.
Blogspot.
Blogspot.
Yep. .com.
Okay, 9/11 plane questions, blogspot.com.
Blogspot, B-L-O-G.
Oh, B-L-O-G, yeah, okay. Good.
Congratulations. You've been so...
Whatever that.
I'm on it. 9/11 plane questions, chopper 5, what plane, et cetera.
Yeah, so that might give us a few things here. I've been asking some questions for a long time, trying to get good answers to questions, and there are a number of them that just no good answers have really come about. If there were planes, there would be, I think, answers to a number of these questions, and I just haven't gotten any. So the very first picture, if you just click on the picture, it should enlarge, hopefully in your browser. That will, like, go to another window.
Okay. It's
no,
also
actually, we had something of a development this week in that Eric Salter released a fairly high-resolution copy of the Chopper 5. Now, he actually has one of the only known copies of the Chopper 5 video that was broadcast once and only once. They never replayed this particular video. It was never put on the archives, but he recorded it on his VHS, and he released a high-resolution excerpt of this a long time ago. But I've been pestering him and bothering him incessantly that he ought to make the entire sequence available in high resolution. And finally, just this week, he did that. And the reason that I really wanted to see the entire sequence and not just the place where the plane comes in there at the end is that the shot opens up with a wide shot showing the skyline of southern Manhattan. It's taken from New Jersey. And the only problem is that there ought to be an airplane in this wide shot, and there isn't. And so obviously the better quality of a version that we can get, the closer we can look into the sky to see if there is an airplane present, and there just isn't.
I'm looking at the enlarged version, having clicked on the image, and I see where you have a big circle that says the plane should be in this vicinity, and of course the circle is empty, and then you show that it should be at least this big and introduce an image of what it ought to look like if it were there, and it's quite obvious it isn't.
Right, now it's not. Now, so where that little image of an airplane came from is later on in the video after it zooms way in. A plane does come into the picture, of course, and so I copied that and then resized it very small. I actually intentionally made it smaller than what it ought to be. I mean, it ought to be about 75% of the width of a tower. And I actually made it closer to like 50% of the width of a tower just to go overboard with making it smaller. Now, you can see in my picture, it's not very big, but you can see it. It would be there. It would be a dark object silhouetted against a very light sky. We have other, you know, other videos of these 9/11 planes where it's even smaller, and we see it. So, and we know about where it should be in the picture, of course, because we can measure backwards from when it does come into the picture. We can say, okay, it's gone this far over this number of frames, so we can then work backwards and say, well, okay, well, then back here at this point in time, it ought to be right about in here somewhere. And it just isn't. This is like the simplest thing in the world to understand. The plane ought to be there, and it's just not. And I think that because this was the video they don't want us to see, they never replayed it. It was cleansed out of the archives. That just right away, anybody can understand that, well, they're trying to hide something. There's something that they don't want us to see. Of course, there's a number of very, very strange things with this video. But number one, it might be there's no plane in the wide shot.
Since Eric Salter is the source of this video, Ace, what does Eric Salter say about the missing plane?
Well, he wrote in his email that he sees some kind of a blurry motion. Now, I'll point out that the frame that you're looking at is just a single frame. That's frame one.
Uh-huh.
I encourage anyone to go and download the video, and I'll try to make that available here with the next segment or something. I should be able to post a link up there for anybody to go and download the video for themselves. He sees a blur that comes and goes that's kind of in the region where the plane might be, but it's a blur and it sort of appears for a few frames and then goes away. And he was going, well, maybe it came out of the smoke and went back into the smoke. And for anybody who's just listening, we see the twin towers on the left side of the picture, and the smoke is drifting to the right, and the plane ought to be over there in the sky on the right. So you might think, well, yeah, maybe it's in the smoke. However, if you would visualize this thing in three dimensions, the smoke was blowing to the southeast that day. The wind was blowing towards the southeast, and the flight path of the alleged plane approaches the Twin Towers from the southwest. And from this angle, we're in the west looking east. The plane would be a couple miles at least in front of that trail of smoke. It just really wouldn't be anywhere near that smoke plume. So it just doesn't make any sense that it would disappear into the smoke.
Very nice. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today is a musician, composer, and expert in digital processing who's been applying his abilities to analyzing the films that were broadcast in New York City on 9/11 related to the planes and come up with some fascinating results. His name is Ace Baker, and Ace, it's just terrific to have you back on the show.
Oh, sorry. I was just taking on the Beatles.
Sounded good. That's your own plane.
I'm here. I'm in my studio with my Steinway. I usually sort of go up and hide in my bedroom. But
how fantastic. So you're a Beatles fan as I am?
Oh, a Beatles, a total Beatles freak. Maybe we'll get into, hang on a minute. Anyway, let's see.
Lady Madonna.
Yeah, I love it.
So listen, I flip back now to the homepage here. We're at 911plainquestions.blogspot.com. For anyone who's just joined us, we've been looking at the first frame of the Chopper 5 video that came in a higher quality version that came from Eric Salter, and we have been observing that there's no plane visible at the distance and approximate location where it ought to be seen.
Right. Now, so, and that's, you know, I mean, that's just a simple thing, but you know, it's an obvious thing. I just haven't gotten an answer to that. I mean, a few other things have been offered. One is that, well, you know, maybe the plane was going so fast initially that it actually was, you know, off to the right of the screen and was just outside the picture a little bit. But we've sort of done the measurements and run the numbers on that. And in order for that to happen, it would have to be going like twice the speed of sound initially and then be slowing down, decelerating very, very rapidly in order to then end up where it ends up in the picture after the final zoom.
Yeah. The first time I heard that very idea, it was simply so bizarre that, you know, it had to be some kind of desperate last gasp to try to salvage an hypothesis that's been falsified by the evidence.
And that's it. So now I've been, you know, if you go down the blog, the last question there on the right says questions for 9/11 plane theorists. And just some of the questions, like what I raised, why was the Chopper 5 footage never replayed despite it being very dramatic footage of history's moment? Now, again, this is it's a simple question. You know, you might say, well, only the television networks can answer that question. Well, okay, fair enough. But you think about how television news is, and when they have dramatic footage of a defining moment, they play it and they play it and they play it over and over again. And in fact, other versions of the plane hitting the South Tower were played over and over and over again. I mean, how many times, you know, did they play the Rodney King beating or whatever? You know, I mean.
Yeah.
This for quite a while was among the best, you know, quality footage that they would have had, the clearest view of this plane supposedly hitting the towers. What reason could they have to not replay this when they were replaying other views of it? They were replaying, you know, the towers blowing up. They said collapsing. Over and over again. You know, give me an answer. If you want me to think there was a real plane there and that there's nothing wrong with this footage, give me something. Give me some plausible reason why network news, being the way they are, the way we know they are, where they will play dramatic footage over and over and over again, why didn't they? And I have... I've posed this question, I've put it on discussion forums, I've sent it out to email groups, to people that I know are in the truth movement but inclined to support the plane theory. I have not gotten any answer at all.
Now, we have the whole footage right here, right, so that we could play it right here on this site. Is that right?
This link to a YouTube...
Yeah.
Is, I believe, to Jason's analysis of where the plane should be. So that's YouTube quality. I will, during the next break, what I'll do on that blog is I'll post a link to Salter's version of it so people can have a handy place to download it.
You know, I just clicked it to watch it, and it says, we're sorry, this video is no longer available.
Oh, no kidding, Dave. They've cleansed Jason's thing, have they? Let's see. Let me click.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Well, it's good. I'll tell you why. Now, so I don't have this posted yet, but I've been editing Salter's footage and attempting to repeat Jason's analysis, pretty much exactly what he did. What he does was is he basically it's a challenge to match the size of frames because there's a zoom in, so you want to make sure you're comparing apples to apples in terms of size. Once you've got the frames matched up in terms of size, then it's about measuring the distance back in time of where the airplane should be. And I've done that. I don't have it posted yet, but although I come up with slightly different numbers than he does, he uses, for example, a 17-frame segment. He says the plane travels this distance in 17 frames, and I used a 16-frame segment that I found. But essentially, it's the same process. I measure that 16-frame segment back a number of times and count the total number of frames, and I come up with the same.
So are you going to be able to put this up now during this break, Ace?
Let me try to do that, and we'll see how long it takes.
Give it a shot. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Special guest today is a musician and composer and expert in digital processing who's been analyzing the videos broadcast out of 9/11 related to the impacts of the aircraft on the Twin Towers, Ace Baker. Ace, have you been able to load it?
Not yet. It could possibly happen by the second hour. I'm exporting out a Final Cut right now, this thing that I did. There's no commentary on it yet.
Sure.
I can probably get it exported and put up into YouTube. It usually takes about 15-20 minutes or something for that to show up.
That's fine. That's fine. We have many other issues to discuss. I know you've been receiving a lot of correspondence from Anthony Lawson, among others, and that most recently he was asking about your financial interest in no planes theory, which I thought was a bit of a stretch. I mean, one might as well ask, what is his financial interest in planes theory? I mean, why do you think he even raised such a question?
Well, spill the beans a little bit. A lot of people in the truth movement know this. I'm busy making a movie, as it were. I'm making a documentary about the science of 9/11, and it's going to be about the World Trade Center, probably 60-75% about the World Trade Center, and maybe the rest about planes and no planes. A few months ago, as we know, Anthony Lawson has a wonderful speaking voice, a narrating voice, and he was actually invited to narrate this film, but it became clear that he wanted to really sort of control the content and the direction of the film. But he was offered, some money to do that. No amount of money was specified. We actually have a low budget to try to get this thing done. I think he's just trying to, cast aspersions on me. And when I answered his email, I indicated, first of all, I'm losing money, making this this movie. We're doing it's a nonprofit educational venture, and I'm certainly not making anything to do this. It's costing me. But I really raised the issue of, who has the financial interest in maintaining the plane hoax. And I think what's at stake is nothing less than the credibility of the entire news media industry. As long as we think there were real planes, we can still pretend that the government did it, but the news media were tricked right along with the rest of us. But if there were no planes, it means that the news media were in on it from the get-go. So I think there's the stakes are huge. The stakes.
Yeah, I think they are. I think you're exactly right that we're talking about the evidence that exposes collusion between the mass media, the government, the intelligence agencies. Anyone who thinks those of us who are involved in these issues is, you know, making money off it, I think simply doesn't understand. For example, I went in the hole to the tune of about $6,000 in putting on the Madison Conference. And now, you know, we have the DVDs available. Anyone who's interested, by the way, should go to 911scholars.org and simply click on the icon for the cover of the Madison Conference DVD, the conference about what's controversial, what's not, the science and the politics, and you'll be able to order it. It's 14 hours, really high-quality stuff. But, you know, producing that, we ran another $3,000 or $4,000, so I'm about $10,000 in the hole on this stuff, Ace, and, you know, that's exclusive of other expenses that one incurs in this business.
You know, and we do it, I think, because, you know, we care about, you know, I think the biggest issue that's at stake in this whole thing is really, I think, just the concept of objective reality itself.
Yes.
I firmly believe that those who gave us 9/11 are convinced that they can control perception, that they can, in fact, create their own reality, and all reality just takes place in our perceptions anyway.
Just as Karl Rove boasted so often.
Right, and we do it because we, I have kids, I think a lot more about the future of the country and of the world now that I have kids, and I have two girls, and they even talk about, you know, when they have kids and when they become mommies, and so I think a lot more about the future, and I think we stand at a very critical juncture. I think we have the opportunity to convince people that there's something really wrong going on here, but that if people would just question and stop believing in it, they won't be able to get away with it anymore.
Well, I think what you're doing is so tremendously important, and I'm just so grateful to be collaborating with persons like you and Judy Wood and Morgan Reynolds and others who care about these things. Tell me what more you have been able to do in relation to the fascinating question about the nose coming through the building. I know you have your A, B, C, D, E, F, different images, and why don't you tell us about that? This is a kind of challenge that you proposed, but which I gather Anthony's been unwilling to accept.
Right. So, you know, the issue is, you know, when you watch the Chopper 5 video, it sure looks like the nose of the airplane pops out from behind the tower on the other side right before they fade to black. But it cannot be the nose of the airplane, so the official story is that it's some kind of dust explosion. Well, then, in the September Clues movie, the maker of that suggested that the nose of the airplane from before it hits the tower was a micro-precision match to the nose image that comes out afterwards. And he shows two images and sort of lines them up and he uses the term micro-precision match. And then Anthony Lawson comes along and says, well, no, they don't match precisely, and they should match precisely, and they don't. And he shows the same two images from September Clues and says, here, look at this one and now look at that one. Look, they're not precisely the same, therefore it's not the nose of the airplane. And so actually neither one of those is correct. On video, the nose of an airplane will not look precisely the same from frame to frame. There are reasons why the shape of it will appear to distort or elongate and so forth from frame to frame. But to me, the question is, well, if we take a number of these images, some that are the nose of the airplane, some are from after it comes out, the nose or the dust explosion or whatever it is, and we take a number of these, well, can we distinguish between the two? And so I've proposed a challenge. I have six images, A through F, and they're mixed up in an order. And the challenge is to look at these and see if we can tell which ones are noses and which ones are dust explosions. And I haven't found anyone yet who's confident that they can distinguish which are which.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, Ace Baker is a musician and composer and expert in digital processing who's been studying the events of 9/11, especially in relation to the videos that were broadcast related to the plane impacts on the building. Ace, I'm looking at the enlarged version of the images of what, you know, the nose or dust or whatever coming from the building. And I thought it was quite important that you made the observation that even if it's film that's been faked so that they've got an image they're moving forward across the celluloid, that in fact it doesn't have to look the same from one frame to another, because that was certainly the basis on which Anthony made a pitch to me about this and suggested when I had him on the air that I should agree that they didn't look exactly the same. And I was temporizing and saying, well, you know, if the film were authentic and they do not look exactly the same, but that I wasn't willing to concede that he'd disproven fakery on that basis.
Right, and on a legitimate video, there's several reasons why the nose of a real airplane would not look exactly precisely the same from one frame of video to the next. The first is that the position and the viewing angle of that airplane is changing slightly every frame. So the actual viewing angle on the airplane is a little different from frame to frame. The lighting, the shadow, the reflections, refractions, the atmospherics, all that is slightly different. But then also, the resolution of video is not infinite. There is a discrimination that the video has to make as to exactly where the end of that nose is. And if it makes it to the next dot or line of resolution or not, these particular videos that we're analyzing were recorded on VHS tape, which actually has a reduction in horizontal resolution. So even further, it has to decide, well, does it make it to this dot of resolution or is it back on this one? So from frame to frame, it might cut off or extend the tip of that nose somewhat. So for all of those reasons, it's just not going to look precisely the same. And you can easily verify that by looking at the first 20 frames of Chopper 5, where the airplane is coming in towards the building, and the noses don't look precisely exactly the same. That thing that comes out the backside, it sure looks like the nose of the airplane. And I can't crop these images and put them to where you don't see anything other than this tip of the nose of the airplane or whatever it is, I sure can't tell which or which. And to be honest with you, I made that multiple choice, the A through F. I've done it some many months ago, and I actually don't even remember. I have to go and check. I don't even remember which ones are which now, and I can't tell, and I haven't met anyone who could tell the difference. And so then you go and think, well, okay, is it likely or is it possible that a dust explosion could be the same shape and the same size and the same color as the nose of an airplane? There's no real reason that it would be, so it would just sort of have to happen randomly. Are there any other dust explosions that look like airplane noses? I don't think so. I haven't seen one. I think reasonably you'd have to say, well, that's the nose of an airplane, because we can't distinguish it from the nose of the airplane. So, it must be the nose of an airplane image. And I think also just gives further reason for why they wouldn't replay that video and why they took it out of the archives.
Oh, I agree completely. I always thought the idea of it being a dust explosion was pretty far-fetched.
Yeah, and in that, actually, that particular explanation really only emerged probably in like the last year or so. For quite a while, as I understood, now I don't think there ever was an official explanation. I don't know whether any of the government reports ever said anything about it. But to the extent that there was some kind of an official explanation, some people were saying, well, maybe it's was an engine or you know, part of a fuselage or some cylindrical object. There are other views of the South Tower impact from the opposite side, some of which don't appear to show anything other than a dust explosion. Others do indeed seem to show some kind of a cylindrical missile-like or nose cone-like silver-colored gray object that's coming out. But then it was pointed out that there's no exit wound. There's no broken columns from that place on the tower. And even an engine to exit from between those closely spaced steel box columns on the perimeter of that tower would have to break those columns. And so there's no exit hole. There's no exit wound. And so that's when really the story had to change. And like so many other aspects of 9/11, it's like the official story will float some idea and put it out there and let it stay out there until somebody shoots it down. Like, I mean, you know, the first official story of the what happened to the Twin Towers was fire melt steel. I mean, that's I've got a nice little collection of news anchors, Garrick Utley and Dan Rather and Peter Jennings and others. We have structural engineers Chris Wise, Hyman Brown on videotape, and all of those people said fire melted the steel. So that's where that story came from, and it was us truthers who came along and said, no, it's about 1,000 degrees short.
Yes. Moreover, I take it that jet engines are made principally out of steel, too, and you'd think they would be dropping off of planes if this were true.
Right, if it could melt it, you know. And, yeah, steel and titanium. And so, you know, so there was, you know, there was no nose cone or engine or any large object, you know, that was big enough to, you know, I don't forget exactly the spacing between those columns, but I don't think it was, you know, more than about 3 feet apart between those perimeter columns. And there's no exit wound on that opposite side of the South Tower. It would be like the northeast corner. And another weird thing about that, you know, that exiting nose cone is if you look very – now, it's tough to tell, but when I look at it very closely and enlarge it, it doesn't look like that nose cone – comes out of the face of the tower where it should. It looks to me like it slips out from behind the tower, which is exactly what we would expect if it was a video composite. And if that edge of the tower was where the mask, that video mask, was, it would slip out from behind rather than coming out from the face. All the way around, and then, you know, of course, you talk about ghost plane and everything. These sure look like video composites.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Ace Baker, a musician, composer, expert in digital processing, who's been analyzing the videos and films from 9/11 in relation to the impact of the aircraft on the buildings. And Ace, if you're up for it, we have a caller from Dan in Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hey, Dan.
Have we got you there?
No, I just
don't. Oh, okay. Okay, thanks. Well, we missed Dan. Maybe he'll call back. Ace, go right ahead. Have you been able to get the upload the YouTube?
It finished uploading, but it takes a while for YouTube to, for it to show up. So I've got the link, and I'll keep hitting it. And if it shows up, then we'll have it. But
that's fine.
I don't want to hold my breath on that one. Basically, I mean, what I did was, in a way, sort of repeat the same, kind of measurements that have been done before, both to just sort of confirm for myself, and also, I'm going to put this in my movie, but the basic idea is to figure out where the plane ought to be in the wide shot based on where it is and how fast it's going in the close-up shot. And indeed, it should be on the screen, and it's not there. That's what it is. Could I just throw a little curveball here and talk about something else?
Absolutely.
I had an idea for a thought experiment, and I just want to throw this out there.
Okay.
This has to do with Judy Wood's work.
Yeah.
And, of course, Dr. Wood has put together the most comprehensive study, photographic and video study of what happened at the World Trade Center, and has concluded that it must be some kind of exotic weaponry that caused this level of destruction, of disintegration. And her leading critic is a guy by the name of Dr. Greg Jenkins, PhD, a physicist, who has written a number of technical papers criticizing her. And his basic point is that he's saying there's just not enough energy in the world to cause this amount of damage. And because it's sort of technologically impossible, he says, therefore he reasons it didn't happen. He says that the photographic evidence is being misinterpreted, that no steel turned into dust, but it must be hiding under in the basements, underneath where we just don't see it in the pictures. It seems to me he's kind of reasoning backwards, sort of, saying, because, we can't explain it with current technology, therefore it didn't happen. So here's my thought experiment. I think this is an interesting way, some interesting question to answer. Let's imagine that it was 1951, 6 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we had the photographs and the films of what happened there. We see the bright flash of the explosion. We see a mushroom cloud. We see the devastation of the buildings. And then we also know that even people that weren't directly injured in the blast, a lot of them were starting to get sick with these cancers and so forth. And our task is using this data to try to figure out what happened. But the catch is, in this thought experiment, we need to imagine that we don't know anything about nuclear physics. We know chemistry. We know conventional explosives, like TNT. And we know that this whatever it was dropped from an airplane. How are we going to explain what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? And I would submit that the Judy Wood of 1951 would collect all of these photographs together and would say, see, this is what happened. Now, I don't necessarily know exactly how, but there must be some kind of technology that we don't know about because, there had to have been some kind of a massive release of energy to cause all of this destruction. And whereas I think the Greg Jenkins of 1951 would basically be saying, well, we can't explain all of this destruction with the current technology. Look, if all of this damage really occurred like you say it did, that would take about 20,000 tons of TNT, and we know that the largest airplane in the world can only carry about 600 tons of anything. Therefore, it's impossible that all this damage actually occurred. It's simply not possible. Therefore, we must be misinterpreting the photographs. All this damage didn't really occur. Maybe you can't really see all that well from aerial photographs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So maybe all those buildings are still there and all those people haven't been vaporized.
Right. To me, it's no less absurd. To me, that's, I think, the situation that we're in. I've read his papers, and that seems to be what he's saying. I mean, assuming there's no kind of technology that we don't know about, I mean, he's probably right, you know. But Judy's right. I mean, this stuff happened. Those buildings disintegrated, and the basements are not full of stuff. And I'm sorry, no huge pile of anything anywhere. Therefore, there has to be, I think, some kind of technology out there that we just don't know about yet.
Judy's initial response, of course, was to ask, well, is he implying that the buildings are still standing?
Right. You know, exactly. He's saying there's not enough energy to do it. Well, so what happened? His answer is, well, no, the buildings aren't still there, but he would say, but, you know, no steel turned into dust or no significant amount of steel turned into dust. And he would argue about the average size of the concrete dust, which, of course, matters because the smaller that dust gets, well, then the more energy it takes to break all those molecular bonds. And so, but to me, it seems like saying, well, it's impossible because there's not enough energy, therefore it didn't happen.
Well, the argument has seemed to me to be at least faintly ridiculous on multiple grounds, one of the most obvious being when he maintains there isn't enough energy on Earth to bring this about. I mean, a single atomic bomb could have brought about the destruction of those two buildings. So why in the world he'd want to make such an obviously false claim is beyond me. But of course, in addition, the first responders like Frank Morales, whom I've had on the show, pointed out that actually the destruction of the tower was so complete, not only was there no rubble pile several floors above ground, the actual destruction was below ground, that you actually had two massive pits where the two buildings had been standing.
And you can see that. We have, both the aerial photographs show what looked like craters, and they have that LIDAR radar mapping that shows two craters.
We didn't have 200,000 tons of steel piled up there, that's for sure. Stand by, we'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Ace Baker, a musician, composer, and expert in digital processing, who's been examining the videos that were broadcast on 9/11 in New York. And Ace, I'm really pleased you bring up this thing about this guy and his attack piece on Judy, because it was dishonest in so many different ways when they put together this hit piece. They used film that showed angles that made it look like there was a massive pile of debris there, when, for example, even Father Frank observed that there were actually these pits beneath ground level, and yet so many people have swooned when they have seen this. To me, it's really unfortunate, dishonest, and deceitful.
Yeah, I shortly after Judy first came out with her paper over a year ago, I got very intrigued with it, and I started building the rubble website that was basically just looking for floor assemblies, looking for perimeter sections, just trying to account for the building, and I questioned everybody, ran these discussion forums, where's the stuff? And they similarly would send me pictures of, a little person with this seemingly large pile of rubble behind them. And even so, I mean, large is a very relative term. And, when you just simply add it up, if the perimeter sections aren't there any more than about 20% of them. We're looking for around 4,800 of those wheat checks, Judy calls them, those 3x3 perimeter sections. We're looking for about 20 miles of core columns. And the the steel just simply isn't anywhere to be found. Some of it is, but it's, you know, if it was, you know, if you see 90% of it, 80% maybe, okay, it's been some of it's been hauled away, some of it's underneath here where you can't see it, but it's not close. It's not anywhere even close to that.
Yeah.
And you're right. And then of course now I think, you know, Judy has uncovered, you know, something even more insidious in that it appears that they brought dirt and landfill into the area and beefed up these piles for photo opportunities, and also to sort of smother out this fuming process that was that went on for so long. But I think a lot of those pictures that do show the big piles appear to show piles of what looks like landfill. It doesn't, you know, it's very strange.
Yeah, Judy's work on the dirt to me has been utterly fascinating. How, you know, Giuliani was talking about all these trucks that were taking debris out, not mentioning that they were bringing in massive quantities of dirt,
you know,
at the same time.
You know, and she was, we actually met in New York and Connecticut a few months ago, and she went down to Ground Zero with Morgan Reynolds, and they're still finding piles of dirt down there, and she talked to somebody, a worker, who said that they were digging that up, and I'm pretty sure that if there ever was any topsoil in that part of the world there on the southern tip of Manhattan, it's been gone for about 100 years. I mean, that's bedrock. I just don't think there's any soil there at all to dig up at all. Somebody maybe will correct me if I'm wrong, but I just don't think there'd be. And yet there's, to this day, there's piles of dirt. And of course, you know, I curious question might be, why haven't they built anything there yet?
Well, I think that's great. And as Judy observed and showed in photographs she and Morgan had taken during their recent visit, they're still wearing these hazardous material suits
and
masks. I mean, that's pretty damn bizarre if there isn't something really weird going on of the very kind that she's been suggesting.
You know. So anyway, back to Chopper 5. So now, Eric Salter, there's a couple other developments with him and this piece of video as well. One that I almost forgot about here, but I just remembered during the break. Now, so, of course, I wrote my paper last summer showing that the motion of the airplane in Chopper 5 becomes more unstable when you stabilize the video, which is an impossible result. Eric Salter has written several criticism pieces on my paper, and his point was that my margin of error that I claim, I claim a low margin of error, and he says, no, the margin of error is much greater, and really all you're measuring with this supposed unstable motion is it's just margin of error, measurement error, and so forth. Then Frank Greening wrote a paper about the Evan Fairbanks video, and his intent there was to show that the plane slows down upon entry. Of course, that's been another issue, is that the airplane videos don't appear to show the plane slowing down at all. And Greening references another one of Eric Salter's papers where Salter does the same kind of analysis of measuring the position of the plane frame by frame, and Salter claims that he shows the plane in Evan Fairbanks slowing down as it enters. Well, so I came along, and in emails to Greening and Salter, I point out, well, wait a minute, in order to try to claim this, you need a very low margin of error. You're doing this exact same kind of analysis, but now when it suits you, you're claiming a very low margin of error in trying to contend that this airplane slows down. This is a huge double standard. And, of course, Salter doesn't have any control cases in any of this stuff to actually try to determine what his margin of error really ought to be. So I called him on. I said, look, if your margin of error in the one is so low that you can claim this deceleration, well, then that means my margin of error in Chopper 5 is low enough that I can show that the plane motion is too unstable, and you're trying to have it both ways.
Yes.
And so Salter has basically thrown out his original criticism paper of mine, and he's redone it, and he has changed his margin of error. He's made his margin of error much, much lower now, and he has now claims that the motion of the airplane is even much more stable than he used to claim. Of course, he still doesn't have any control case.
Fascinating. If Dan in Massachusetts wants to call in, please do call after this break, Dan. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest today, Ace Baker. Today, my special guest is Ace Baker, a musician, composer, and expert in digital processing. And we're discussing research he's been doing on the videos and films related to the aircraft impact in New York. Ace, we have our caller on the line, Dan from Massachusetts. Dan, welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to ask you guys, what do you think that they're going to do next? I wanted to first ask that and then tell you what I think they're going to do.
You mean, are we going to have another false flag operation here in the near future?
Yeah, as far as false flag operations. Yeah.
It's not impossible. I had a guest on several times, Captain Eric May, a former Army intelligence officer who's an expert on covert operations and so forth here in the U.S., and we were very concerned about events out in Portland when they were conducting operations there. We thought November might have been a crucial month. I would love to believe that the window of opportunity has slipped by. The administration is in so much trouble that it's very difficult, however, to dismiss the idea that they wouldn't be willing to take another shot at it. Ace, would you like to contribute a comment on this?
Yeah, well, yeah, I think, you know, they got their endless war, you know, so they got that. Probably they're going to want, you know, Bush and Cheney, you know, let them be, you know, reviled and hated. That way, you know, when they're gone, people can sort of think, oh, well, okay, you know, yeah, they were bad, but, you know, we've gotten rid of them. I predict that when the new administration comes in, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, the war will continue, of course, but it'll sort of go off the front pages and out of the news, and the real focus is going to be on global warming and health care, and I think that they're going to work on trying to, you know, continue to increase the police state via taking over the health care industry and whatever measures are supposed to, you know, reduce energy consumption or you know, whatever they're going to try to do to supposedly fix that.
One of the huge residual problems, of course, derives from the use of these depleted uranium weapons in Iraq. An awful lot of these Christian fundamentalists who've been so enthusiastic in their support of George Bush may not realize that Iraq is one of the oldest civilizations in the world and that the Tigris-Euphrates Valley is the home of the mythical Garden of Eden, and that we've been just distributing depleted uranium all over, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, which coincides with scientific estimates of the age of the Earth. Tremendous genetic abnormalities result from exposure to this stuff, and all kinds of medical problems ensue. I'm willing to guess that we're going to have 10 times to 30 times as many victims, casualties, American casualties from exposure to depleted uranium as we have that are casualties from bullet wounds or shrapnel, even from these improvised explosive devices, and that the damage to the Iraqi people is going to be overwhelming. In fact, this stuff gets blown all over the world. They've been measuring it in London, for example. And there are going to be permanent effects here that are going to affect alter the evolution of the human species because of these genetic consequences. But Dan, I want you to go ahead and offer us your opinions.
I think that they're most likely going to hit New York again, possibly a few other targets. And what I think they're going to do specifically is let off some type of nuclear device. And then when the cameras start rolling, they're going to let off another one, just like they did on 9/11. Well, not just like they did. They didn't let off a nuke on 9/11, but just like we didn't see the first building get hit and then the camera started rolling on the second one, and then we saw the second plane hit.
Why do you
it's
think
be similar? I think.
Why do you think New York again?
It seems like an ideal target to them. It seems like just the way that it worked out on 9/11. It seems like they would like to do that again.
Do you have an idea about the timing when something like this might take place?
I would think they would do it in the day again.
During the day, but I mean, when in terms of the political calendar, for example, in the near future, within a month or two, would you anticipate?
It's hard to determine. I don't think that they really like Bush because he's really not that smart. So I think that they would wait till another president got in. But we don't know what they're going to do exactly. But I can't.
You're not thinking of this as a way of salvaging Bush and Cheney in power and suspending the Constitution and putting the country under military rule.
No, I don't think that they want to do that because
okay.
Bush hasn't really proved himself to be ideal for dictator, I guess
okay.
you could say.
Nice point, Dan. Well, look, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Ace, tell me, where are we? Did we get our upload on our YouTube?
I just clicked on it. It hasn't showed up yet.
Okay. Well, why don't you continue?
I will say there's another thing that I'm doing with this with this Chopper 5. And, of course, this is my favorite 9/11 video precisely because I know it's the one they don't want us to see. Therefore, I'm the most interested in it. So my original analysis that I spoke about it in Madison was analyzing the velocity of that plane and showing that it becomes unstable when you stabilize it, and that is the horizontal velocity. So now I've taken Salter's new version, which is the highest quality known version of this, and I've stabilized it again. This time I've got After Effects now, which is able to do even a higher quality stabilization than what I did before. And this time I'm going to look at the vertical motion of that airplane, a Y dimension, because that too should be very stable. And I have stabilized the video. I haven't yet measured the positions of those airplanes yet, but just eyeballing it, I can definitely say that the problems with the vertical stability are even more obvious than the horizontal. Of course, if the camera moves up, well, that plane should move up. If the camera moves down, that plane should appear to move down. I just by eyeballing it, again, I haven't measured it out yet and done the graph, but just by eyeballing it, I can tell that the motion of that airplane, rather than being married to the twin towers and the rest of the real elements, appears much more married to the graphics, the overlaid graphics that you see on the screen, the NYW Fox 11 or Fox 5 and all these graphics. And as they move up, that plane moves up, and as they move down, that plane moves down, which, it just tells you that this plane is a graphic. It just doesn't make any sense when you stabilize the video. The motion of the plane becomes more unstable, and I believe I'll be able to show that that's even more obvious with the vertical up and down movement of that airplane even than it was with the horizontal movement. So that's new and in the future. And also, we can talk about the kindly Dr. Pedant. When we come back to that.
Okay.
Some nice emails with the kindly professor from Northwestern.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Ace Baker. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. My special guest today has been Ace Baker, who is a musician and composer and expert on digital processing, and we've been talking about his recent research on the videos that purport to show planes impacting with the World Trade Center, in particular the Twin Towers. Ace, you wanted to bring in some new issues. Please do.
Well, yeah. So, so I've been interviewing some people for this movie that I'm working on. Went up to Toronto and talked to Frank Greening for a few hours once, or a few months ago. And as I think many of your listeners know, the government reports have never attempted to model the collapse, the quote-unquote, of the Twin Towers. The NIST report, of course, stops famously with that phrase, you know, global collapse ensued, you know, when they purport to show that collapse was initiated. In fact, I think the only people in the world who really have attempted to model how a gravity collapse could proceed would be Frank Greening and Zdenek Bezant of Northwestern. And so I interact with Greening all the time. I email him. And his model allows for, at most, only about 20% of the mass of the towers to go outside the footprint. And, of course, when you look at these videos, it looks to me like the towers turn into powder and explode outwards, and it looks like almost all of the mass goes outside of the footprint of the tower. And, of course, that's very important because if there's not, you know, if there's not a lot of mass that stays inside the footprint, well, then there's nothing pushing down on the intact building in order to make it collapse. So I got into a discussion with Dr. Bezant, and of course he is infamous in my mind because he first produced his first paper on the Twin Towers a whopping 48 hours after the event, which if you just think about that, it's, if you know anything about science papers, I mean, you know, to try to explain the most unprecedented event in engineering history, 48 hours after it happened, it's just, well, it's just hard to take. But in any case, we were talking about the mass of the towers and what happened to it and where did the material go. And he was trying to explain to me how, you know, vertical motion can be translated into horizontal motion, which I understand, yes, something falls and it can deflect off of this and then go sideways. But now, and this is astonishing, I mean this is earth-shattering. Are you ready for this?
I'm listening.
According to Bezant's mathematics, which I'll admit I don't understand his mathematics, but what he said to me in his email is that his mathematics allow for 100% of the mass of the towers to go outside the footprint, and that collapse could still continue on.
This is pretty bizarre.
I can explain what, you know, what his reasoning is. And again, somewhat analogous to Greg Jenkins, he's reasoning backwards. He is saying that, okay, we observe this amount of material going sideways, therefore we can infer that there must have been a certain amount of force coming down to have caused that mass to then go sideways. Well, it seems to me, yeah. Okay, assuming it's a gravity collapse, yes, absolutely. If you assume that, then that energy had to have come from somewhere. But that's the whole point, of course, is that we can't assume it's a gravity collapse. You have to say, you know, well, maybe it's a gravity collapse, but maybe it's some kind of huge weapons or explosives or something. You know, and yeah. And if, you know, if your math and your assumption leads to some kind of an absurdity, that's when you have to come up with something different. Yes, his mathematics, he told me in his email, allow for 100% of the mass to go over the sides. And I wrote him back. I said, you know, I'm glad I stuck to music in college because I don't think I could have ever gotten my mind around a massless collapse.
What's collapsing anyway, you know? I mean, what's left to collapse if it's all been projected outward?
There's been another startling admission, and this from Frank Greening. I've been pestering him and pestering him. And I interviewed him, but there was, you know, things I didn't get to in the interview. And, of course, his He contends that you know, the towers basically ended up in the basement, and that it, most of it stayed in the footprint and it all fell down. And I asked him, you know, what evidence do you have for a gravity collapse? Well, you know, because his mathematical model shows that a gravity collapse is possible, but just because something's possible, that doesn't mean it occurred. And so I keep asking him, what evidence do you have of stuff in the basement? What evidence do you have of a gravity collapse actually occurring? And finally, he wrote to me, I have no evidence. And those were his words, no evidence.
Really?
That was his exact words. Frank Greening said to me in his email, no evidence. And you can bet your bottom dollar that that phrase, no evidence, is going in my movie. I mean, you can bet on that.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Well, among the topics we haven't discussed lately that you have here on your blog spot is, of course, the entry of the plane into the building of the South Tower. And, of course, every time I see this footage, I'm just stunned and appreciative of why some of those who are raising complaints so early on, like the Webb Ferry and Gerald Holmgren and others, were Nico Haupt, were alarmed by what they were seeing and felt it was completely inconsistent with the principles of physics.
That's right. The you know, you see the plane, you know, go into the building and it looks like it just, you know, disappears gradually in there, and you don't see the crash physics. And that goes back, as you say, to the early researchers, Holmgren and Rosalie and others. And the explanation that survived for a while was that the quality of the videos is too low. The hole appears in the side of the building, but the quality of the video is too low, so you can't see it. And I think what I did, and I think it's original with me, is that I put together a frame from the same video. And here we're talking about the CNN Hezarkhani video that Rosalie calls Ghost Plane, well-named Ghost Plane. I took a frame from the same video that is zoomed out even farther away slightly than it is when you see the plane penetrate. And this zoomed out frame shows the hole in the side of the building quite clearly. And I matched them up and put them together. And you can easily see the gaping hole in the building. The hole is very dark and there's no light inside the building, whereas the side of the building is gray and well lit up. And so the point is that I think we've shown that there's 20, 30 times enough resolution and quality in that video to see the hole in the side of the building. And when that plane goes in, after the wings are already inside, there's no hole in the building. There just isn't.
Ace, I can't wait to have you back, my friend. Keep up the great work. Anyone who doubts, you know, that the cutting-edge research is taking place, they better be tuning in here, because that's where it's taking place. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Dynamic Duo. Thank you all for listening.